This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and welcome to our virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Of course, we're running out of August, which means we're running into September, and that means it's time for an editor's roundtable. We do those once a month. And regular on our roundtable is Dave Thompson, Prairie Public's news director. He's with us in our studio in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Doug.
With you, Steve Andrist, the executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Doug. How are you?
I'm fine. And April Baumgarten is with me. She's a reporter for the Grand Forks Herald, but she drove down to Fargo to share a microphone. April, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about the really big story that's going to continue for, dozens of days, months, a couple of months. That's the Kevin Cramer versus Heidi Heitkamp election campaign. President Trump is coming back to Fargo. This time he's going to have a meal. It's a fundraiser. I think it's on Friday. So let's talk about the tone and tenor and where we are with this race.
Well, let's start by just saying that this is not unexpected, that it was going to be a lot of money poured into this race. You're seeing an awful lot of spots on television, and they're soaking up every available second they can. And, of course, they have primacy when it comes to television and radio. If spots are available, you have to sell it to them at the lowest price per unit, I think is what it's called nowadays. I remember I used to be in commercial radio at one time and the other back before the Earth's crust cooled, so I knew about these things at the time. So, it's been a campaign that I think has been probably a lot of what we expected. I'm thinking.
How about you, Steve? What's your take on it so far?
Well, yeah, I'm kind of interested in, we've had a lot of attention from Trump administration officials in North Dakota, which is to a large degree unprecedented, I think. And it's clearly an indication that that this race means more to just those of us in North Dakota. It means something to those both parties in Congress. Neither one of them wants to lose a seat and potentially lose some control.
No, that is. It's kind of a balance of power midterm election. And April, from your perspective in the Northern Valley, any observation to offer?
Well, I know that the Kevin Cramer campaign wants to cover every part of the state. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, he asked Vice President Mike Pence to come to the Air Force Base. It got a lot of attention. I was a little surprised that they didn't try to get more coverage out in western North Dakota. Maybe that's just because I grew up there. It's going to be attracting a lot of attention across the state. And I think anytime Kevin Cramer can get a big voice out here, it's going to give him more media coverage.
Well, let's talk about some of the issues that are driving this campaign and that will likely make play a role in how people vote in November. Let's talk about trade, the potential for a trade war with China. That seems to be heating up. I mean, more and more tariffs are being imposed. And the trade agreement renegotiation that's underway right now with the North American Free Trade Agreement. Trade is pretty important to North Dakota, Dave.
It certainly is important, and I'm hearing a lot about that from a lot of farmers, especially soybean growers, who are really concerned about losing that Chinese market because the tariffs would drive them out of the market. So that's a major concern. And, of course, you're talking about renegotiating NAFTA and, you know, the announcement that Mexico had reached kind of a deal with the United States. I did happen to ask Representative Cramer when he was at a news conference today, is it NAFTA without Canada? And he kind of looked at me, he laughed, and he said, well, we're hearing stories that they're not that far apart in Canada. They do have some issues. And I think when we talk to the Canadian ambassador, we understand what the issues are. They don't like this five-year bailout clause that's in there that you can leave after 5 years. They want maybe a look-back provision would be better on that. And there are some things that they need to work out. But Congressman Cramer is saying that the president is kind of backing off a little bit, you know, negotiation tactic. So I think that one bears worth watching.
Well, Steve, there was a little bit of good news for newspapers in the state and across the country, for that matter, because newsprint was one of those issues that was hit with the tariff.
Most definitely. It's been a very, very big issue for newspapers. Tariffs that were imposed on Canadian newsprint, imports of Canadian newsprint, were, in fact, driving the cost of newsprint up for North Dakota newspapers and those across the nation anywhere from 20% to 32%, depending on where they source it. A very important expense that's been difficult to recoup, and you've seen some reaction to that. Part of the reason that some of the forum papers are eliminating their Monday publication, print publication, and just doing Mondays online is because of the cost of newsprint that's been driven up so high. And this week, yesterday, Wednesday, I think it was, the International Trade Commission reversed those tariffs. The process is kind of interesting, I guess. It's not all that transparent because we won't know for a little while yet what the rationale was for reversing the tariffs. But we do know that they reversed them, and that over the course of time, those monies will start coming back so that it won't be impacting newspapers who are at a kind of a challenging time in their history already. So that is very good news on the trade front. As far as the soybeans and tariffs involving with trade to China, I think NAFTA is eventually going to work its way out, it seems like. It's just a matter of getting through the process, and probably when it's all done, everybody's going to be happy. On the Chinese ones, especially for farm commodities, it seems to me like you still have the two camps of farmers. You have those who are ardent Trump supporters who are trying their best to say that we need to hold tight and let the process play out and that we'll have some gain as a result of this short-term pain. And you have others who are saying, you know, we took years and years and years to build those soybean markets, and now with a slash of a pen, they're going to be gone, and it's a part of our livelihood. So it's a political issue, and I don't know if that one's likely to quiet down anytime soon.
Well, Steve, do you think that will change these? You know, North Dakota was a major red state, huge margin of for the president, for President Trump's election. This is looking like a bit of a referendum on the Trump administration. Do you expect to see a significant difference when people go to the polls in November?
If I could predict that, I wouldn't be sitting here with you today.
What a careful answer.
I don't know. Anyway, I mean, even with all the polls, you know, the polling that gets done in these elections is never reliable either. You know, each side and each particular group comes out with a poll and they all say different things. And even when they say the same things, it's not necessarily an indicator of what's going to happen.
So that means I can channel my inner Edwin Newman and say, ask not on whom the poll palls, it palls on me.
Okay. Dave's one pun for the Editor's Roundtable is now out.
Only one?
April, Steve mentioned that publication issue. The Grand Forks Herald is dropped Monday publication.
Yes, and we actually began that this week, and it's been really interesting, especially from a newsroom side. We are having earlier deadlines. I don't think we can ever go back to having a Monday edition once you drop that. It's the same thing was in Dickinson. You don't ever get that back. But as a newspaper and anyone in the newspaper industry, I think we need to figure out how to get more of a new audience and to sell that online initiative. You can go online, get news anywhere, whether it's real or fake. You can decide what news you want to believe. And I think the newspaper industry really has to step up and figure out what our audience is, how we sell that, and how we try to get back into the online game.
Well, all of us who are in the news delivery business, whether it's broadcast or print or online or whatever it is, are being affected, I think, by what's going on nationally, what the president is often saying virtually every day now, especially if he's at anything like a campaign rally. He talks about fake news. That it's getting some traction, Dave.
It is, but again, I think if I can be crass for a moment, it does play to his base. It plays very well to his base. There's been a mistrust of some of the news media that's been fostered over the years by talk radio and things like that. And, of course, the now you have talk television, which, you know, if you want to get a point of view, you turn to one of the cable channels. That's my opinion. Eventually, I think it may all kind of wash out. At least I'm hoping it will, that we'll get back to trusted sources. It may take a while. But, you know, if we have an online presence and we show that we're trying to just report the facts, report the news, I think it's going to work out pretty well.
Well, Steve, papers across the state and across the nation earlier this month published editorials sort of out of great concern about this idea of fake news and about the people who are in the news business being enemy of the rest of the people.
Yeah, and I don't really think, particularly in markets like North Dakota and in rural areas, I don't think that most people really view Prairie Public or the Grand Forks Herald or the McLean County Independent as an enemy of the people. It's a good talking point. The danger is that everybody gets painted with the same brush.
Mm-hmm.
And when that brush casts such a wide swath, it impacts everybody. And we have seen, even on the local levels in rural places in North Dakota, where the same sort of enemy of the people attitude does get expressed. Even in small town newspapers, somebody will say, well, you're just fake news. And I think the danger of that is we all know it's really not true. I think if you look at the headlines of Prairie Public's newscast from day in and day out, you will not find many things that would be probably any things, I guess, that would be considered fake news or that wouldn't be real news that's delivered to people. And on the other end of it, you know, on the national spectrum, we have all these echo chambers out here now where people go to look for information. I don't call it news. I call it information or commentary that confirms a point of view that they already hold. And it's kind of like a mob mentality where you get into a group where all people think alike and they just get more and more vociferous and convinced that the point of view that they want or that they hold is the one that's there.
Well, North Dakota has its own echo chambers, and you can go up on Twitter and Facebook and find people who reflect whatever view you want and basically narrow the feed just to hear from them. April, you have been a crime and courts and education reporter. You've covered general assignments as well. Have you run into any of this in your day-to-day work?
I think I've been called fake news maybe twice in my career, and it was always kind of interesting to see that pop up. It just some of it was like, yay, I'm fake news. But on the other side, in a serious note, it's really concerning to me that people have lost trust in the media because it is such a – I was listening to Katie Couric this morning talking on a radio station, and she mentioned that a lot of people have lost faith in news over the years. And my question is, how do we regain that trust back? How do newspapers and radio stations, local TV stations, how do they regain that trust?
Yeah, I think it's dogged attention, but my heavens, it's going to take some time, it looks like.
They make a very good point here about, you know, they mention the media as a monolith. Mm-hmm. Media isn't a monolith by any stretch of the imagination. I think Steve and I here in the studio could say it's – one of us could say it's sunny outside and one of us has to check out and see if we're right.
Well, that's Dave Thompson, our news director. Steve Andrist with him, the executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. They're both in Bismarck. April Baumgarten, a reporter for the Grand Forks Herald, is with me in Fargo. And we'll be back with our editor's roundtable in a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's our Editor's Roundtable. We do this once a month. Dave Thompson, our news director, and Steve Andrist, executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association, are in Bismarck. April Baumgarten, a reporter for the Grand Forks Herald, is with me here in Fargo. Let's shift to some real statewide stuff. We've been talking about sort of an election process that has a lot of national tentacles. Let's talk about the North Dakota budget and where we are with that, Dave, because we've been hearing about the potential for more cuts. We've been hearing about the oil patch doing pretty well. Ag is under stress, tariffs, trade wars. Where's the budget?
It depends on what day and who you talk to. But I trust some of the sources that have been talking about what the situation is. And it's looking better than it was 2 years ago. The oil taxes are flowing again, and there have been some sales tax increases in the oil patch. But that's an interesting story in itself because you have a couple other dynamics here. If you look at the four largest cities in the state, their state sales tax collections are down and city sales tax collections are down. I'm talking about Bismarck, Fargo, Minot, Grand Forks. But out in the west, Williston's picked up again. Watford City's picked up again. Dickinson's picked up again. So things are looking good there. And there's the one thing that I think everybody's wondering what is the effect going to be is when all the online retailers have to start collecting North Dakota sales taxes October 1st. And how that's going to impact the budget is going to be very interesting.
So whose ox is going to get gored?
Well, I think there are going to be some reductions. They did announce, of course, and it's just finishing up this voluntary buyout from state employees, and more than 200 have asked for that, and I think it was 115 alone out of the Department of Human Services. But the governor, in his budget guidelines, said in your recommendations, you can reduce 5% if you're a smaller agency, or 10% of your budget if you're a larger agency, and he was talking about some reductions in state employees, saying that there are probably ways to do some efficiencies. But the good news for that is that everybody in leadership seems to be talking about state employee pay raises again, because state employees for the last 2 years have had to go it without a pay raise. And now they're talking about raises again. So there are some, I think, some pretty good signals in the budget. But some things are still a little bit unknown.
Well, Steve, the state does have some rainy day funds, and there's one great big one that has been chatted about during these difficult budget times, the legacy fund. Do you sense any movement to dip into that, use it?
Yes, I do. As you know, there have been a couple of fairly significant proposals to do that. And you just got to think that that there's a lot of legislators out there who are kind of mulling things over in the back of their minds to see what might apply and what they might be able to do. And I mean, logically so. You know, at some point when you start to create a long-term savings account, you have to stop and say to yourself, okay, why are we saving this money? Mm-hmm. What's the purpose of saving it? If we're just going to save it forever, It doesn't make any sense to have it in the first place. So, I mean, I think it's a logical conclusion that you come to at approximately this point in the game to try and identify what are the best ways to do it. I think it would be interesting if rather than accepting individual proposals from majority leadership or minority leadership or whoever, if we had a system where we could get everybody together and say, what should our top priorities be? And then how can we focus that money back down to take care of those priorities?
Well, in April of this year, the governor had early budget guidelines, which indicated a pretty good reduction again to the North Dakota university system. Mm-hmm. Another 10%, $50 million. One of the two big institutions in the state, UND, is in Grand Forks. How does President Kennedy, what does he think about this, do you think?
Well, obviously he's asked, he's thinking he wants to get raises for his employees. They've been on a raise freeze for either 2 or 3 years. And his focus is making sure that research, higher education is refunded again. And I think a lot of legislators that I've spoken with sympathize with that. They realize that if they cut higher education, it's probably not going to be a good thing. The same with K through 12 education. I think that kind of has been kind of put to the wayside a little bit. They didn't reduce funding, but they didn't increase it. And, of course, costs.
The costs keep going
up. Yeah. So I think that is going to be a priority that a lot of legislators are going to look at, both trying to get some funding back into higher education in K through 12 this year.
Well, I've been intrigued by the number of times I have seen the presidents of UND and NDSU together recently talking about common interests in public. Is this a change to you?
Well, whenever you think about the Bison and the Fighting Hawks or anything Grand Forks and Fargo getting together, it's always a surprise. I think the university presidents are realizing that they can't go it alone anymore. They need to come together, get a game plan for the legislature, and try to figure out what their common interests are. And if they have any differences, put that aside for a little bit.
Doug, to me, this is one of the most significant developments in higher education in a long time. I mean, I'm a UND guy. Dave's a UND guy. If you pressed me, I would admit to cheering for the Bison in the national championship, but only if you pressed me. But one of the original purposes, it seems, of the chancellor system and the higher ed board system was to avoid duplication, to get people working together in a common interest. And we have failed largely throughout the years at doing that. So this is one of the most surprising and potentially beneficial attitudes that we've seen in higher education, I think, in a long time.
Well, I think the point that the writing is on the wall is well taken, because the universities are – they're both research universities, and they're thinking that, you know, maybe we need to start looking at things jointly to attract more research. Because, you know, when federal dollars dried up for a while, nobody was getting research dollars. And now it's starting to come back again. Maybe they're going to try to be a little bit smarter about it.
Well, Dave, there's also this movement that's been underway for a while to reorganize higher education governance.
Yes. And some of the proposals that have come out of there have been very interesting. The one that intrigued me was this three-tiered system, you know, to have the two-year schools, or whatever you want to call it, the two-year schools, as one tier. Then you've got the four-year schools without graduate programs, a second tier. And then you've got the research university and graduate schools on a third tier. I know that's at least been a subject of some major discussions in that task force. But I remember back in the 1980s when they started talking about, is there a better way to governance? There were proposals to do a one-tiered system or a two-tiered system, that everybody would be part of a UND system and an NDSU system, or everybody would be like in Minnesota, a state college and university system. And then they came up with this proposal, tried to be as unified as possible, and then you still had some parochial interest that's going on. But I think as higher education is looking at eras where budgets are tight, they may be saying, we can't do this anymore. We might have to find some ways to corroborate even more. But there's been a lot of collaboration. Besides that, it doesn't get a lot of attention. But for example, if you go to Bismarck State College, you can get a four-year degree through Dickinson State. So that there are those type of things too.
That's Dave Thompson, our news director here at Prairie Public. He's with Steve Andrist, executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association, at our studio in Bismarck. April Baumgarten, a reporter for the Grand Forks Herald, with me here in Fargo. Dave, let's get a sense of the oil patch. How are things going there?
Seems like the things have picked up after a slowdown a couple of years ago. I've been hearing, you know, anecdotally, the traffic is back up, lots more trucks. And things are going pretty well, but of course, we have this little issue out there with the flaring restrictions. They're going to start ramping up again in November, and there's a little concern in the oil patch because gas plants are coming online, but not fast enough necessarily. So there's a bunch more coming online, two I think this year and four next year. That's going to help a lot when it goes to 12% flaring, 88% capture. So that's one issue that's out there. But by and large, there's a lot of optimism again.
So, Steve, are people pretty bullish on the patch right now where you are?
I think there's a little bit more optimism that's returned. Well, one of the things you've seen happen, I think, as the oil play, I don't know if we should call it a boom anymore, but as the oil play has matured, is it's pretty much identified where the sweet spots are, mm-hmm. and it's focused on those sweet spots. Originally, when it took off, it was like we need to stake our claim to all these territories and get some drilling in place and some wells developed so that we don't lose the leases on them and that sort of thing. Now I think you'll see probably primarily in Montreal, Williams, McKenzie counties, and Dunn County. I don't know the figures offhand, but it's what's going on now is kind of focused on that central area where the sweet spot of the oil play is. And I don't think you're starting to see quite as much traffic in the fringe areas, which logically would be return to development, Divide and Burke and Stark and Billings. And once the sweet spot is more developed, then maybe it'll filter back out that way again.
I've been seeing oil trains again, more oil trains, and I did note that the Dakota Access Pipeline has been, pretty busy, and that I have seen, Dave, that this has had an effect on the value of North Dakota oil.
It has been. The premiums that were taken from North Dakota oil being shipped out of here are down quite a bit thanks to the pipeline. So that's helped, but as Justin Kringstad of the North Dakota Pipeline Authority will tell you, it depends on where the best price is because mm-hmm. it might be East Coast. It might be – there's really no pipelines going to the East Coast or to the West Coast. It basically – the oil moves basically south, the way I understand it, and into the Midwest areas. The refinery Flint Hills gets a lot of Bakken crude, so they're geared up for it. Also some of the Gulf Coast refineries. But you're seeing a lot back – toward eastern U.S. and some out to the west as well.
Well, we still remember, of course, the raw moments around that pipeline, the protests that erupted around it. It was a pretty ugly set of months for the state of North Dakota and the world's view. And now, Dave, you just posted a story today about a legislator suggesting that not to pay off a $12.8 million Bank of North Dakota loan for the costs of law enforcement around DAPL.
That's right. The Adjutant General had brought this up to the Emergency Commission saying, well, if they don't, get federal funds for this, they may go for a deficiency appropriation to pay off the loan and then hope for federal funds later. Well, State Senator Ray Holmberg from Grand Forks, who chairs Senate Appropriations, saying, we need to keep the loan in place because it would be harder to go back to the federal government saying, hey, we pay this off. Why don't you reimburse us for it? Instead, hey, we've got this $12.8 million loan out there. We need help. We need you to step up to the plate and do what you were supposed to do to begin with. So I don't think there's going to be a lot of appetite if they want to go and pay off that loan right now. I think they're still trying to get, the Corps of Engineers and the Justice Department to kick in some money.
Okay. Stay tuned for that. Well, let's move on to another issue that's likely to generate a fair amount of interest around the November ballot, and that's that recreational marijuana initiative. There was a big play in the newspapers, probably across the state, certainly in Fargo-Moorhead, a big story about a new poll done by the Odney Group in Bismarck that indicated that recreational marijuana is not in great favor across the state.
Yeah, I thought that was odd. Wasn't it like 39% that they said it was in favor?
Right.
I thought that was extremely low.
Well, I thought the sample was interesting. 400 respondents and 60% of these questions being done by landline. I don't know if that's actually necessarily a cross-section of the state. Steve, do you have a sense of that?
Was it 60% landline and 40% mobile?
Yes.
I'm not a polling expert, but I don't think those are unusual totals for what normal polling is in North Dakota these days. I could be wrong about that, but to me, the big issue is not so much. We tend to respond to these issues based on our guts, and a certain number of us are going to be against it no matter what. A certain number of us are going to be in favor of it no matter what. But as they say, the devil is in the details. And I've started to read – I haven't studied it yet, but I've started to read about some of the potential problems that could be associated with the measure as it is, as this particular measure is written in terms of the decriminalization and driving while influenced, and how does it apply if it applies to the Indoor Clean Air Act. And I don't know if
wouldn't these things have been litigated to some extent in Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and other places that have been applying this experiment pretty broadly?
Well, except we're going by a law that's proposed in North Dakota,
right?
So what the words in the North Dakota measure say is how we're going to be governed.
And there are words that are problematic.
Well, as I said, I haven't studied this, but what I've read is that there are concerns that that there may be an issue related to whether, because it's decriminalized in relation to being nonviolent offenses, that there is a question about whether you could be cited or charged with driving under the influence of marijuana. I think that's a question. I don't know the answer to it, but if it's true that you can drive high without consequence, then I think that would be concerning to people.
Mm-hmm.
If it's true that you could walk down the hallways of the Capitol smoking a joint, I think that would be concerning to people. Now, don't mistake that I'm saying those things are true. Those are things that I've read about and I think deserve some further study before we can make a decision. And going back to the point that the devil is in the details, and we need to learn these things before we can cast an informed vote.
April, I thought one of the more interesting results of this poll, which had a margin of error of plus or minus 4.9%, was the very big difference between age groups, mm-hmm. the 35 and under, overwhelming support.
Mm-hmm. And I hate to state the obvious, but that is what's going to matter at the poll is how much the people that are supporting this measure can get those young voters out or anyone that does support legalization. I wish that the state of North Dakota could figure out what age groups do vote, but that's the beauties of not having to register.
Well, Dave and Steve, typically voters skew a little older, typically,
mm-hmm.
but in North Dakota, anything that sort of breaks the mold, anything that brings out a new surge of people who don't normally go to the polls can really change things for all kinds of things on the ballot, can't they?
Mm-hmm. They can, Doug. I hate to say it, but people our age vote. April's age, not quite so much.
Yeah, you're right.
But if something brings out people April's age and to a greater number than they normally would show up, it's not just marijuana that might be affected.
Mm-hmm. It's across the ballot.
Yeah. Interesting. We'll see, I guess. That's the we'll see argument of waiting for November. People actually have to vote. The initiated measure for an ethics commission this has been batted around. Dave and I have talked about this over and over again, but it's been batted around in the legislature for a very long time. Now people will be voting on it.
Right. And if you look at it just from a 40,000-foot level, you say ethics, that's a positive thing. Then you get into the details and there are some quibbles there. And one legislator who has been not a fond of an ethics commission – who argued against it at the Greater North Dakota Chamber Policy Day, you know, he was arguing against it and then said, I will introduce a bill to create an ethics commission, which I thought was extremely interesting because I think there's some tea leaves being read now, whether or not they're right or wrong, that there will be a groundswell of support for an ethics commission in North Dakota.
Steve, your take.
Well, I think that's quite possibly true. Again, we're talking about the devil in the details. You know, I don't think anybody really has any opposition to ethics in any way, shape, or form. But how do you do it? And to me, the broader picture here, the broader question that comes up with this is how is the best way in our state to make laws and to amend the Constitution? When you go through the legislative process, you have the ability to have all kinds of different ideas debated. When you go through the initiative process, you have a group of people who have a specific interest in an issue who choose this is the way they want to do it. And you don't get a chance at that point to say, okay, well, let's amend this in and that out and let's change a few things here and make it so it's more palatable there. You don't get the legislative council weighing in to say, would this affect other areas of the law? So it becomes a case where you have to be informed and to cast an informed vote, you have to study the issue yourself and understand what it means.
Okay. So the initiated measure process, which is near and dear to a lot of North Dakotans and, of course, is typically has something on a ballot every statewide election, Dave, that's maybe a little bit under the microscope, too, because of all this stuff?
Right. And Ed Marcy's Law and some other things that have happened in North Dakota through initiated measures. And I think really the driver for the interim committee that's studying it might be the medical marijuana thing that passed.
Okay.
And they're looking at ways to, you know, increase signature requirements or do something. Or there was even a proposal to have the legislative council look at an initiated measure before it went on the ballot. And the legislature has tried to weigh in. To they take a look at the fiscal effects of initiated measures, what it might cost. And they want to have that process a little bit more honed so that voters know a lot more about it. So there are a lot of proposals out there that some, quite frankly, you could probably look at and say that's curtailing the process.
Dave, we're going to have to leave it there because we've run out of time for our editor's roundtable. Dave Thompson is our news director. Thanks as always.
You bet.
Steve Andrist with the North Dakota Newspaper Association. Thank you, Steve.
Good to be with you.
And April Baumgarten, a reporter for the Grand Forks Herald. Thanks for joining us today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Coming up next on Main Street, Matt Olien reviews blind spotting.
Well, we're feeling the Western and Canadian wildfires this summer right here in North Dakota, aren't we? All you have to do is go outside and breathe, and you know we're affected downwind of one of the worst fire seasons in modern history. And while fires, yes, have always been a part of life out west, are such catastrophic summer events now the new normal? On this week's Prairie Public Presents Blue Dot, Wildfires, we'll talk to experts who will weigh in on the many factors affecting western wildfires and take a look at the difficult solutions needed to overcome these annual disasters. That's Blue Dot Wildfires on Prairie Public Presents, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, it's time to go to the movies with Matt Olien, and this week Matt went to one that hasn't been getting a tremendous amount of hoopla, but certainly sounds interesting.
It is interesting, Doug. It's called Blindspotting, and it is co-written and starring and produced by two childhood friends who are in the film. David Diggs plays Colin. He is a young African-American man who has just done prison time. He is out on probation. He lives in a halfway house for a year, and basically the film follows his final 3 days in the halfway house. He's got to stay out of trouble. He's got to show up for work on time. He's got to avoid fights. He's got to avoid all kinds of things so that he is free after that to live, you know, with his mom or wherever he wants to from the halfway house. I should mention, Doug, David Diggs was in Hamilton. He played Thomas Jefferson and Lafayette in Hamilton. He is a very talented actor, and he's tremendous in this film. The film is co-written by Rafael Casal. Rafael Casal, white actor, he's actually a poet. He grew up with Diggs, and they co-wrote this film. It's directed by Carlos Lopez Estrada, but really it's Diggs and Casal, kind of their friendship growing up. And so you have a lot of kind of realism in this film. Now, Casal plays Miles, and he plays Colin's friend, his white friend. They grew up together. And basically, Miles kind of identifies as part of the black community. If you see the film, you'll understand what I'm talking about. And he kind of grew up in the black community in Oakland. He's a very dangerous guy. Colin works with him. They're movers. They move people. You know, they move boxes and people and things for people. But Miles is the dangerous one. And you get the sense watching the film that Colin is conflicted. Do I still hang with Miles because he's had my back since I was 11? Or should I get away from him because when I'm around him, he's explosive. Violence can happen. And if you watch the film, you're going to see exactly what I'm talking about.
So is this a buddy film or something different?
I think it is a buddy film, Doug. It basically works that way. But there's always this lighting of the fuse. When Miles is on screen, when Rafael Casella is on screen, you feel like something awful could happen at any moment that could jeopardize Colin's probationary period. I did like this film quite a bit. It kind of comes off funny in the early parts, but you're kind of wondering when is this going to veer into tragedy? And the tragedy happens very quickly in the film as Miles is driving home from work and witnesses a black man shot in the back by a white police officer. He's the witness, really doesn't do anything about it. The police arrive, and he kind of carries this around for 3 days. Should I do anything about this? Should I report what I saw? What should I do? And so that's kind of the backdrop for his last 3 days on probation. But again, as I said, the real thing about the film is the buddy aspect between Miles and Colin. The film is sort of interestingly directed. It sort of looks like it's jarring at first, and the director's going all over the place with kind of rapid editing and things, but it actually all leads to something by the end of the film. It all makes sense by the end, and I actually felt this film said more about the current African-American experience than either Black Klansman did or Sorry to Bother You, which was the other film I did not care. I did not care for Sorry to Bother You. Black Klansman is a Spike Lee film, which I did like, but I like this one better.
Well, this takes place in Oakland. Oakland, of course, right next to San Francisco. One city just incredibly expensive and gentrified. And another one, Oakland, now going through gentrification. Isn't that part of this story, too?
It's a huge part of the story is the gentrification of Oakland. Who really belongs in Oakland? And we get some very interesting scenes. There's a fascinating scene at a party where Miles and Colin attend a party, and Miles is one of three black people at the whole party with a lot of white people. That's an interesting scene that builds to quite an explosive climax. So a lot of issues going on here, Doug. Police brutality, gentrification, what the city of Oakland is going through, and really Colin trying to get his life in order. He's got an ex-girlfriend that he's trying to kind of reconnect with, trying to stay clean, trying to have a better life for himself. We do eventually learn why he ended up in prison. That's not known for a while. That's quite an interesting scene as well. You know, the film isn't making a ton of money, but I do think it's the best of the three that I've seen this summer that really comment on the African-American experience today.
Well, what about these two auteurs that kind of, you know, put together their own movie and star in it and all that, write it. Any Oscar legs for something like this?
I doubt it. You know, I think Black Klansman probably has more Oscar legs because it's Spike Lee.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is the better film, even though it's directed by a first-time director, Carlos Lopez Estrada. This film has a gritty realism to it, Doug. I felt like I was in Oakland. I felt like I was on the streets of Oakland, finding out what life is like in Oakland, which is, you know, many times a very depressed city, especially compared to its sister city, San Francisco, as you aptly mentioned, Doug. I just think this film really captures what life is like for Colin in Oakland, growing up as a black man in Oakland, and Miles growing up as a white man in the black community. That was a fascinating thing as well. And so I'm glad that they collaborated on this. Diggs is a fantastic actor. Of course, he was in Hamilton. He has a monologue in this film that really has to be seen to be believed. It goes on for about 4 or 5 minutes, and it's quite impressive.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing this film. I really am.
You better see it soon. I just don't know how long it's going to be around.
All right. Well, let's talk about the passing of a giant in the entertainment industry, Neil Simon.
Yeah, Neil Simon. There was a time in the 70s and 80s, Doug, he was the most famous playwright in America. And his plays are all kind of similar. They're about kind of the Jewish experience. Very funny, The Sunshine Boys, The Odd Couple, Barefoot in the Park. Goodbye Girl was not a play. He wrote that directly for the screen. I generally liked his stuff. There was a sameness to it, though. I felt after a while I was kind of almost seeing the same play over and over and over again. Of his screenplays and plays that were made into films, Doug, I think I like Barefoot in the Park the best, the Robert Redford, Jane Fonda film from 1967, but certainly an enormous person in American theater.
Well, he was nominated for 4 Oscars for Best Writing Screenplay.
Okay.
So we usually ask you for the winners, but what 4 okay. Neil Simon movie scripts were nominated for Best Writing Screenplay?
So The Goodbye Girl for sure,
yes.
In 1977. I don't think he ever won one of these screenplay Oscars.
He didn't.
Was The Odd Couple screenplay adapted?
Yes.
68. Okay. I'm going to say Plaza Suite in 71.
No.
No.
Another suite, though.
California Suite in 1978, and I'll say The Sunshine Boys in 75.
Well done, Matt O'Lean. We've been to the movies.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a consumer-owned power cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with nearly 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 31st. On this date in 1906, the Grand Forks Evening Times highlighted the exploits of an unsung hero, the railroad detective. Railroad detectives had a long history in the United States. As the railroads expanded across the West, there were not enough U.S. marshals to protect passengers and freight. The passengers were vulnerable to banditry and con men, and the freight was a tempting target for theft. The history of the railroad detective goes back to Alan Pinkerton's detective agency in the 1850s. Pinkerton met with George McClellan, the president of 2 railroad lines, and also the railroad's attorney, a fellow named Abraham Lincoln. Pinkerton subsequently established the Northwest Police Agency and began supplying detectives to the railroads. The culprit was often a railroad employee. It was easy for the conductor to underreport the number of passengers and put the extra money in his pocket. The detectives also posed as ordinary passengers to investigate such employee theft. They also discouraged union organizers, sometimes by violent means. The 1800s were called the Golden Age of the Con. Train travel made it easy for a con man to pull a swindle and get out of town before he was discovered. So con men flourished on the trains and took advantage of naive travelers' gullibility, many of whom were traveling for the first time. The cons often involved card tricks and sleight of hand. Others were more complicated. In one con, a lovely female traveler would feign illness and asked a gentleman traveler to get help. While he was gone, the woman's partner would quickly snatch any luggage the man had left behind. When the helpful man returned, the woman would say she had fainted and knew nothing of the theft. Books like The Anxious Traveler gave advice on how to avoid such scams. It was the job of the railroad detective to keep an eye out for the con artists and to arrest them on the spot. This hero got some attention in the 1950s with the TV series called Matt Clark, Railroad Detective. It told exciting stories of the Old West as the hero captured the bad guys. And you might be surprised to learn that railroad detectives still ride the rails today. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Earl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
This week on Away with Words, when giving directions, you must be very precise.
So the other day, I was in the car with my friend Corey, and Corey was giving me directions, and we came to a stoplight, and he said, okay, he's like, at the light, go ahead and hang a Roscoe. I was like, no, you mean hang a Ralph. I don't know who Roscoe is. And he's like, well, I don't know who Ralph is.
Join us.
Who are you? You're crazy.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, we'll be preempted for a special documentary based on the oral histories collected by the late author Studs Terkel. In the early 1970s, Terkel went around the country with a reel-to-reel tape recorder interviewing people about their jobs. The result was a book titled Working, and that'll be the subject of that documentary during Main Street's Hour, Monday at 3 o'clock Central. On Tuesday, we'll talk with Republican Kevin Cramer, who's stumping the state to trade his seat in the House of Representatives for Democrat Heidi Kuykamp's seat. We hope you can join us for that as well. And, of course, Main Street Weekend is Sunday morning at 10 Central. So, in the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Friday.